Hey guys, I'm Heidi Preeb. Welcome back to my channel, or welcome if you're new here. This season on this channel, we are talking about change. And today in particular, I want to talk about two concepts that I think we tend to mix up quite a bit, at least in pop culture lately, and how I think that placing either thing in the wrong category is not always going to get us the results that we're looking for. And these two concepts are self-awareness. So understanding ourselves and our own patterns and triggers and what makes us tick and how to work effectively with our own patterning when different parts of what we want are in conflict with each other. And the concept of relational awareness, which means understanding things like the effect that we and our nervous system states and patterns are having on the people around us, as well as how we are being impacted by the people and the environments and the context that we are interacting with. And the reason why I think it's important to kind of keep these constructs in their individual boxes, at least to some extent, is because if we start looking at everything through the lens of self-awareness, a pattern that we can start falling into is believing that we have to be perfect and other people have to be perfect before any form of healthy relating can happen. Or that if there are problems relationally, the only way to deal with them is for each individual person to go do their own work. And I want to be clear that what I am not saying here is that self-awareness is never something we want to focus on. Okay, this whole channel is more or less a testament to the importance of self-awareness. But if self-awareness is the only tool that we're relying on to make our relationships work better, we're probably leaving out a whole host of skills that could really help us when the going gets tough. So, what we're going to be talking about today is the difference between self and relational awareness, and in particular, where self-awareness kind of hits its natural limits in relationships, and how relational awareness can take over from that point in order to help us navigate both relationships and just the general situations we find ourselves in life more effectively. So, a very simple way that I like to think about the difference between these two concepts is thinking of self-awareness as kind of akin to being a really good mechanic. So knowing exactly what makes up the car that you're driving, as well as how to repair it when things go wrong. But knowing everything about the car and how it's made up does not tell you a whole lot about how to navigate traffic, right? When two cars crash into each other on a highway, it is much, much more often the case that one or both people were not paying proper attention to the rules of the road than it is that one of the two cars simply had a malfunction that caused it to totally lose control, and if that one car had just worked on itself harder, it wouldn't have happened. Much more often, we're experiencing crashes because people aren't coordinating well with the traffic on the road than one or both cars just has an issue in a vacuum. And I believe that a lot of the time, this is what's happening with people as well. Okay, so if we start looking at every single collision that we enter into in life as a mechanical issue on either our part or the other person's part, and we only look at it through the lens of what work does one or the other person need to do, we are ignoring huge amounts of information that might be relevant for helping us prevent crashes in the future. So this might sound kind of funny, but I started thinking about this concept when I had a friend who got really into interior design. And he was explaining to me that when you walk into a room that you have set up in a particular way, you are obviously taking in the room with your five senses, right? So you're noticing things like the light that's filtering into a room, what furniture is set up and where, and what designs that creates, whether the colors of the room are complementary with each other, whether the decor kind of makes sense internally. And so he explained all of these things through the lens of these are the things that you are processing when you walk into a room. And then he went, but also, every time you walk into a room, that room is processing you. And that sentence made no sense to me. And I was like, what do you mean the room is processing me? And he said, if you walk into a room that is well lit versus a room that is very dark, each of those rooms are going to elicit a different nervous system state in you. If you walk into a room with soft, comforting textures versus a room with harsh, kind of rigid textures, that's going to elicit something different in your nervous system. So just like you are taking in and processing the room around you, the room around you is also processing and eliciting different responses in you. based on the elements of it. And the reason why I wanted to bring that example into this video is because I think that when we are not super attuned to something like relationality and how other people and different nervous system states and different tendencies in the people or environments around us are impacting us, we tend to get incredibly judgmental. And if we don't feel good around someone, we can chalk all of that up into individual pathologies and draw conclusions like, if I'm feeling badly around this person, they must have meant to piss me off or to hurt my feelings or whatever it is. But sometimes someone's natural way of being simply processes us in a way that we don't enjoy. The same way some people really love dark rooms and other people hate them. And if we lose perspective on the fact that all of us exist in this complex ecosystem where we are constantly eliciting different parts of one another and both processing and being processed by one another in different ways, it's going to be really challenging for us to form any sort of reasonable or charitable interpretations of the people in our lives. So we're going to go over some of those differences between self and relational awareness and what each one can tell us, just to start moving into some of those areas where we might have blind spots. I do find that on average, those on the more avoidant side of the attachment spectrum can have a blind spot around how they are being affected by the people and environments that they're a part of. So they have this tendency to kind of think of themselves and judge themselves in a vacuum and think that if there's work to be done in a relationship, each person needs to do it individually, and that's the only way that things are going to start functioning more smoothly. And then those on the anxious side of the spectrum tend to have a really strong awareness of how they are being impacted by the people and environments that they're a part of, but they can have a pretty big blind spot on how they are having an impact on their environments. And so which part of this you're going to need to do more tuning into might be totally individual, but in general, just like there's always more that we can learn about our self-concepts and how to work with ourselves more effectively, there is almost always something that all of us can learn about how to coordinate with each other more effectively. So the first difference between self and relational awareness that we're going to talk about today is that self-awareness looks at our relationship to our own nervous system and getting to learn and notice its patterns, whereas relational awareness focuses on how our nervous systems impact other people's and vice versa. Now, before we dive too deeply into that point, I just want to take a quick minute to thank the sponsor of this video, Factor. The last couple of weeks where I live, the weather has been so beautiful and summery and warm. And every time it starts turning into spring like this, I have all of these really great intentions of spending all of my time outside hiking and socializing, and then coming home and cooking healthy, delicious meals, only to find that I do really well at the first portion of that equation. But then what I end up coming home to is unused produce slowly dying in my refrigerator. This year, Factor has been a very helpful solution to that problem. Factor delivers chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals straight to your door. Their meals are made with real ingredients, balanced macros, and at least two vegetables per meal. And for me, one of the biggest benefits is that there's no prep and no cleanup. They also have globally inspired dishes and over 70 add-ons, including things like green juices, breakfasts, and many other convenient options. 97% of people say that Factor helps them live a healthier life, and 92% say that it makes their lives less stressful. I use Factor, and you should too. Head to factor75.com or click the link below and use the code PREBFB50 to get 50% off your first Factor box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code PREBFB50 at factor75.com to get 50% off plus free breakfast for 1 year. This offer is only valid for new Factor customers with the code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. All right, back to that point about self-awareness as an awareness of how our nervous systems are dynamically interacting with other people's. So I have a friend who I will call Mark, who has generously allowed me to share this story. And Mark always had a really challenging relationship with his brother, Cameron, who is 3 years older than him. So growing up, Mark had always felt like he was the kind of brainy, nerdy kid in the family, but his older brother was the cool, jockey, charismatic, and popular one who Mark kind of wished he were more like. And so Mark really struggled to connect with Cameron. And as they grew up into adults, Mark was routinely trying to form a relationship with his brother, and he just couldn't figure out how to do it. And one day he was on the phone with me ranting because he had just tried to give his brother a call and talk to him about something that he thought they would both be interested in. And he went, "You know what? I think my brother is just not that intelligent. Like, anytime I try to have a conversation with him about what matters to me or topics that I think we would both find interesting, I just get these really kind of bland, checked out responses from him. And I hate to say it, but I think he's just not that smart." And then a couple of months later, Mark went to go visit Cameron in the city where he lived. And for the first time, he got to see him around his coworkers and his friends. And he came back and went, "Oh my God, my brother is smart." Like, around all of these other people, he was able to carry on these very intelligent conversations. Everyone was telling me how they relied on him for all of these high-pressure things at work. And just generally, I saw this totally different side to my brother that I have never seen before. And over a series of conversations that happened in the next year, Mark and Cameron were able to root out that what had happened was that from a young age, Mark had felt so threatened by the ways in which he thought he was inferior to Cameron that his most common defense mechanism of getting really intellectual and heady was super online almost every time he was talking to Cameron. And Cameron was reading this as his brother thinking that he was better than him, feeling like he was being condescended to in most of their conversations, and that was causing him to kind of clam up and feel like he couldn't relax enough to form a good thought or really flesh out any particularly interesting lines of conversation. But Cameron was not unintelligent. It was just that Mark had not realized that for a good 30 years now, he had been approaching his brother in a particular pre-defended state, which had elicited a certain version of his brother that he mistook for the whole of his brother and assumed he couldn't have a connection with him. And this is an error in relational awareness, right? Mark was aware of his own defense mechanisms. He could very easily and cleanly name that he used intellectualism as a way of kind of avoiding uncomfortable feelings. But what he had no awareness of was the impact that it was having on his brother and what version of his brother he was seeing. So the really cool thing about coming into an awareness of this, of not only what's going on in my own psychology, in my own nervous system, but how are the people around me responding to the state that I am arriving into connection with, can give us a lot of information about how to bring out different sides of the people in our lives. If we feel like we're really stuck in a conflict with someone, we can start asking ourselves questions like, what helps this person to relax? What types of people do I see them naturally feel more comfortable around? And are there any states or traits in myself that I can bring into this connection that would allow this person to feel more comfortable around me? Sometimes the traits that we're assuming are fundamental and pervasive to people's personalities are actually context dependent. And if we can find ways to work with the context, we might find that we have a lot more opportunities to connect with people than we might have originally thought. And of course, this phenomenon goes both ways. So the second thing I think it can be incredibly helpful for us to stay aware of is the fact that self-awareness is a really good tool for helping us figure out who we want to be and what versions of ourselves we want to grow into. Whereas relational awareness is a really helpful tool for helping us figure out which contexts we can put ourselves in that are going to make those changes much, much easier and more sustainable for us. I remember reading this advice column once that kind of blew my mind because it was so counterintuitive to the way that I think, which is that someone wrote in asking this advice columnist, how do I know that someone in my life is actually going to change for real? Like, they keep making these false promises and I don't know when to believe them and when not to. And the advice columnist listed a bunch of things that indicated in his experience that people were more likely en route to making a lasting change. But he said the most important thing to pay attention to is, has this person embedded themselves in structures? So in relationships, in support groups, in environments, where they are going to be consistently inspired as well as held accountable to the changes that they want to make. And this advice columnist's argument was that if we are not in environments that are super supportive of the changes that we want to make in an ongoing way, our likelihood of sustaining those changes are incredibly low. If we want things to actually start patterning out differently in the future, we have to be putting ourselves in environments where the new ways that we're wanting to show up are a better fit for that environment than our old ways of showing up. And if we are consistently ignoring the role of environmental design in the process of any change that we want to make, what we're essentially doing a lot of the time is just forcing ourselves to endlessly swim upstream, which becomes incredibly exhausting over time. Whereas if we wanted to be wise and discerning about changes, we would make sure that we were putting ourselves in the right environments for those to happen more naturally. So an easy example of this is that, as many of you on this channel know, I spent years and years and years working on my attachment issues and working on my toxic shame and on all of these other parts of my own makeup that I believed were getting in the way of me having easier and healthier relationships. And much of that self-awareness work was incredibly valuable. But I also found myself kind of getting stuck in this pattern of any time a partner or someone very close to me had a criticism of me, taking it really intensely and really to heart, because I had this really strong inner critic that was helpful when it came to that self-awareness piece, but that very often felt incredibly heavy when I got into close relationships. Because if I felt like I wasn't being perfect enough in my close relationships, it would drag me right back into my avoidant pattern. And then the first time I ever dated someone who could just laugh with me about the things that I was getting wrong, and who held things like conflicts and differences of opinion quite lightly most of the time, I realized that there is a totally different energetic state that I could be in that would allow me to approach mistakes that I had made or things that I was getting wrong in a relationship with a spirit of relaxation and openness. And I learned that for myself, in relationship with people who can do that, I tend to be a lot more naturally open and undefended than I am in relationship to people who tend to approach those things with a much more serious tone. And so what would be a downward spiral in one relationship becomes an upward spiral in a different one. And this is where we get into the territory of understanding compatibility, right? Some people are actually quite triggered by humor. And for those people, it would be swimming upstream to be in a relationship with someone who liked to deal with conflict humorously. So this is all about getting to know ourselves, but then taking it past that self-awareness piece and then looking at things like which traits in other people tend to naturally open me up and leave me less defended, which environments consistently bring out the best in me, and how can I set myself up for success by putting myself in as many relationships and environments and contexts as possible that are going to bring out the parts of me that I most want to exist in the world. So something it took me a really, really, really long time to realize is that when we think of that adage of the two wolves, so that old folk story that goes something like a grandfather is talking to his grandchild about how he has two wolves inside of him, one that wants to behave selfishly and badly, and another one that wants to do good. And the child goes, well, how do you know which wolf is going to win? And the grandfather says, whichever wolf you feed. It took me a very long time to realize that we are not the only people feeding the wolves inside of us, right? The environments that we're a part of, the relationships that we're embedded in, all of those things are feeding us constantly, sometimes without us noticing. So if we can ask ourselves the question, how do I most often put myself in the environments where the good wolf in me is getting fed? It is going to go such a long way towards helping us make those changes that we want to be making both internally and in our relationships. The third distinction I think it's so important to look at here is kind of the flip side of this. So self-awareness gives us insight into what our defense mechanisms are and what they look like. But relational awareness draws our attention to which contexts or situations our defense mechanisms are most likely to overwhelm us in. It is very hard to heal, to resolve conflict, or to make any sort of significant change inside of environments where we are getting routinely triggered and where we are regularly getting pushed outside of our window of tolerance into one of those four F responses, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. When that happens every once in a while, often we can regulate around it, come back to the issues at hand, and resolve them from a calm place. But if we are either inside of close relationships or inside of contexts that are basically triggering us on a daily basis, it is going to be really difficult to use tools like self-awareness or just individual nervous system work to keep ourselves regulated over a long period of time. Being in environments that consistently dysregulate us does not give us enough time with the versions of ourselves that are wise and capable of integrating challenging situations to do their thing. We all learn best, integrate lessons best, and change best when we feel resourced and capable. And so if we notice that we are stuck in either a job or a relationship or some other environment where we are continuously and routinely getting triggered, or where our defense mechanisms are coming online super strongly, well, it is absolutely useful to do things like go to therapy, look at those defense mechanisms, understand how we might be able to resource ourselves better. At a certain point, we also need to look at, can I change my environment to one that does not trigger me as often, or that does not trigger me in these same ways, so that I am dealing with these triggers when they are at a 5 out of 10, rather than consistently at a 10 out of 10. And again, what's interesting about this is that what is triggering or overwhelming for different people is so unique and doesn't necessarily say anything moral about the environment or the person that's doing the triggering. It can, right? But it also can not. So for example, in my really fearful avoidant days, I was most triggered by secure environments. And this is not that uncommon for those with disorganized attachment systems. What was least triggering for me was to be in environments with people who had kind of similar types of wounding to me. So people I could joke with about my own wounds, people who kind of understood if I needed to pull away for long periods of time because they operated the same way. So in a vacuum, these were not the most ideal or secure environments, but they were the environments where my particular nervous system was least overwhelmed, ergo was most capable of making changes. I know that sometimes we don't have the degree of choice that we would like over the environments we're in, but I think it's just helpful to keep that in mind, because if we are in contexts where we are triggered on a daily basis, that's just a good thing to know about why we might be struggling to make the changes that we want to make. Sometimes the reasons that we're struggling are quite relational, which on the optimistic side of things also means that we can look at making environmental changes that can better support us, rather than just assuming that if we're consistently getting triggered, it's always a personal failure, right? We do not exist in a vacuum. We exist inside of dynamic ecosystems of other people and other scenarios that are all constantly processing us the same way that we are processing them. Which brings us very naturally to the fourth point that I wanted to talk about today, which is that self-awareness helps us understand things like how we tend to respond to conflict, but relational awareness helps us intelligently design the conditions that conflict happens under in a way that gives us the best possible chance at creating the outcome we want. So when we look at conflicts through the lens of self-awareness, very often what we're looking at are things like, how mature are both people? What are their attachment styles? What inner patterns are going on for them that might not be healed enough yet, or whatever it is that is making the conflict go so wrong. When we look at conflict through a more relational lens, what we're looking at are things like, which pressures are on both people that exist outside of this relationship? And how are those pressures influencing the ways that they're able to show up inside of this relationship? Which can extend to which pressures are on the relationship as a unit. So a couple who is on the verge of bankruptcy has a lot of forces impacting their relationship relative to what it might look like if that same couple were more financially resourced, right? When we are under different types of stress and pressure, different parts of ourselves come out. And those different parts of ourselves sometimes lead the charge when it comes to how we're interacting with other people and the conflicts that we're having with them. Being able to develop as much awareness of that as possible when it comes to the conflicts that we're having with other people, goes a pretty long way in being able to kind of check ourselves for why certain patterns might be coming out now that maybe weren't coming out in the beginning of the relationship or whatever it is. And the really cool thing is that relational awareness also takes into account which strengths individual people or the relationship as a whole has that can be used as resource points during tough conversations or rough patches in the connection. So I will never forget once going out and having a beer with a close friend of mine who is probably one of the most relationally aware people I have ever met in my life. And he was talking about this conversation that he knew he had to have with his partner that was going to be challenging for them both. And the way that he was approaching this conflict was blowing my mind, because he essentially started out by taking an inventory of all of the things that he knew his partner did really well in resolving conflict, and then was thinking about how to design the conversation in such a way that her conflict resolution skills could really shine and his conflict resolution skills could really shine. And so instead of going in with this attitude of me versus them, he was looking at it through the lens of, I assume that we both want to resolve this. And I also assume that there are these kind of failure modes we can get stuck in that I don't want us to get stuck in. So how am I going to design this conversation in a way that naturally elicits my partner's strengths and naturally elicits my strengths so that we have the best possible chance at finding something that makes us both happy? And there are so many ways that we could get granular about this. So looking at everything from when are you having a given conversation and in what setting and in what mood is that person likely to be in based on the set and setting that you've picked out? But also, what energy are we showing up with? And how is that impacting the way that the other person is experiencing us and what that's going to bring out of them? But the most important thing here, I think, which is what I took away from this conversation, was that we want to think about which parts of a person we are appealing to. If we go into a conversation appealing to the part of the other person that we truly believe is reasonable and willing to work with us, it's often going to pattern out very differently than if we go into the conversation appealing to the part of the person that we think is unreasonable and trying to fight against that part, right? And so this all comes back to that awareness piece. Where do I and this other person, or me and this other group of people, tend to get stuck? Versus where are we collaborating really well? And how do I gear whatever I want to have happen between myself and this other person or group of people in the direction of what I know is most likely to succeed? This is what relational awareness really helps us with. And the opposite of this, just to contrast it with something quite different, is being completely blind to how the context of a given relationship is influencing what's coming out of people in the process of. So there's this thing that I see online every now and then where people have this idea that you can just speed run something like intimacy or a romantic relationship. And the reasoning is usually, well, the more that we get to learn about each other really, really quickly. So if we get into a relationship and start spending all of our time together, surely we will gather more accurate data more quickly than if we were to have a relationship at a more normal pace. But what that approach completely fails to acknowledge is what the structure of that relationship is doing to both people inside of it and impacting how both of them are showing up, right? But those same two people might, in fact, behave quite differently in that context than they would in the context of a relationship that happens more slowly. So you are, ironically, not at all getting to know the whole person if you are only relating to them inside of this very intense and unusual context. You are getting to know the version of that person that exists inside of that particular intense relational context and whatever triggers come up for them around it. But that might be very different than how those same two people exist inside of different contexts that are more relaxed. And to be clear, I'm bringing this up not to debate the pros and cons of how fast a relationship should move, though to show my hand, I don't think that intimacy can be sped run in any particularly effective or healthy way. But the point I'm making is that if we are not looking at the way that we are approaching relationships as a factor of how people are behaving inside of them, we are missing out on a massive amount of context that is actually going to be really important for getting to know a person well and for designing the right environments in which the best parts of both people are able to routinely come out. And the final distinction that I want to draw today between self and relational awareness is that self-awareness, once again, looks at most problems, including relational problems, through the lens of what am I or the other person doing wrong? Whereas relational awareness sees the realistic limits of given connections or given relationships. Okay, and this is something that I do think more securely attached people tend to have a kind of natural grasp on. So when they are struggling in relationship with people, securely attached people are much more likely to look at things like, when that person is behaving the way that they are, what does that bring out in me? So if someone is being really avoidant, if they need a lot of time to self-regulate and to pull back from connections when they're feeling stressed, how do I feel about that? And if I really struggle with that, then what that means is that's probably just not the most compatible person for me to be in a close relationship with. But maybe I can be that person's friend. Or maybe they can be an acquaintance that I really enjoy seeing whenever I see them without any sort of expectation of how often that's going to be. Whereas when we're stuck in that self-awareness frame, sometimes we can forget that we have control over the degree to which we can be close or not close to someone. And we can start to think, if I like someone and they are doing things that make me uncomfortable, then my only option is to try to change them or to try to change myself. Whereas relational awareness draws our attention more to what we need from relationships at different levels of closeness, and it helps us to draw our boundaries around those things, again, without pathologizing about them. I can know that I fare the best inside of relationships where there's a healthy mutual sense of humor online without pathologizing people who don't prefer to work through conflict that way. That relational awareness piece just gives me information about how my nervous system interacts with other nervous systems and what that means about who it's going to be easiest for me to be really, really close with versus who it might be easier for me to be friends with, but not best friends with. And this doesn't mean that we're blind to the ways in which other people might be mistreating us or that we're endlessly forgiving. It just means that we understand where our boundaries need to be to keep ourselves feeling okay, regardless of how other people are going to behave. And so ironically, having that better awareness of boundaries often also allows us to have more grace and forgiveness for the ways in which other people are struggling, because we know that we can protect ourselves by finding our right distance from those people using that relational awareness piece. All right, I could go on forever about this topic, and so there may be some follow-up videos if that's wanted. But I think what this really comes down to at the end of the day is that self-awareness is a really good tool for examining ourselves sort of in isolation. So looking at that whole system that is ourselves and how it operates is incredibly useful and important. The same way it's useful and important to understand how a car operates if we want to build a car. But relational awareness helps us to understand ourselves and other people within the systems and contexts and mutual forms of influence that we all exist inside of. And so this is that process of learning to understand traffic patterns, not just individual vehicles. Both are incredibly important for understanding how to navigate the roads safely. All right, I am going to leave this video at that for now. But as always, any questions, curiosities, anything coming up for you guys as you've gone through this video, please leave them in the comment section below. I love you guys. I hope you're taking care of yourselves and each other. And I will see you back here again really soon.